certainly good having you here.
Thank you.
I admired Vita's harp very much. And I think the best compliment that I could give to a writer, to you, or to anybody, especially to you, is that I've learned to read more of everything you've done. I went out and I bought
more of
your books, and I've started Book of Lights, the one about the rabbi in Korea, and haven't started this one yet.
Mm.
But I went out and haunted the secondhand bookstores looking for the earlier books.
Right.
And I did see the movie The Chosen, which I liked. I thought did you think they did a good job?
Yes, I thought they did a very lovely job. I thought they caught the quality of the book very accurately. And I especially like the fact that they kept the passions low-key and made the background material very authentic, and no attempt to dilute any of that core culture material. I thought it was rather expertly done.
Even Rod Steiger restrained himself.
That's right, and very effectively so.
Yeah, I thought he was quite good.
Because by restraining himself, the last scene came through as powerfully as it did.
I somehow don't mind it too much when Rod Steiger overacts. I think he's such a magnetic actor, but he drives some people up the wall. But he was so heavily disguised in that beard in that movie anyway, you didn't even know it was Steiger.
Some people actually didn't recognize him. He told us a story once of going up the elevator in his hotel room, in his hotel here in Manhattan, and two ladies got into the elevator with him. And they started to talk about a Rod Steiger movie they had seen on television the night before. And they were discussing Rod Steiger, and there he was in the elevator, listening to them discuss Rod Steiger. None of them recognized him because the beard that he wore, he actually grew. And really, you have to sort of look very hard to see him, and you do a double take when you finally realize who he is in that movie.
Well, I live here in Manhattan, and you walk out on the streets, and there are celebrities everywhere. I mean, just in Midtown, I mean, I go into Doubleday, and there's Ally McGraw, and go into the Gotham, and there's Roy Scheider. But most of us don't look at each other, at least people who live here, I don't think we look at each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I head as fast as I can up and down the sidewalk,
sure.
And I look down, and I don't really look at faces, and I have a feeling that we probably should, just to get the character of all the people who live here. But the fact is, there's a great deal of anonymity in this city. You would think that it's so small, and boroughs so small, and people would stand out. But actually, the streets are so crowded, and people are often out of context.
I think that cities this size tend to breed anonymity. I also think that people come here precisely because of the anonymity. There are people who are achievers in their particular field, and I don't imagine they want to walk down a street bent on their personal business and at the same time get themselves recognized by every passerby. It makes life very difficult and, in the end, rather tedious. So I suspect that they rather welcome the anonymity. At the same time, I also suspect that deep down inside themselves, they want to be recognized from time to time by someone at least two or three times a day, you know, as they do this anonymous journeying through the city.
Well, when I saw Ally McGraw on Doubleday, she had asked for a book on philosophy of some kind, which they did not have. I was right behind her. I always liked Ally McGraw. And so after she left, I said to the sales clerk, I said, "Did you know that's Ally McGraw? That was Ally McGraw." And the clerk said, "So what?"
Mm-hmm.
Are you a New Yorker?
I was born in New York, bred in New York, grew up in New York, educated in New York, and left New York for a very long trip to the Far East, courtesy of your uncle and mine.
Brooklyn?
I grew up in the Bronx, was educated in Manhattan. Then when I came back to New York, I was married, and we lived in Brooklyn for a couple of years. My wife grew up in Brooklyn. So between the two of us, we've sort of covered most of New York.
Did you read this article in the Times last Saturday, In Search of Protestants, about
yes.
a boy
lovely,
growing up in
lovely
I didn't know if you'd seen it or not. I clipped it for you because here's a boy who grew up, and he was aware of Irish and Italians and Jews, but he never saw any Protestants. And I thought that was kind of funny, because all the ethnic parades that are held here in New York, giant parades, the Columbus Day Parade, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, and all that. And I was thinking, you know, there's never a parade by WASP. And if there were a WASP parade, it would be very short. They would march across Fifth Avenue instead of up Fifth Avenue. Have you ever heard of a parade by WASP?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, it's called Fourth of July.
Well, that's true.
The fact of the matter is that major cities on the East Coast, especially the Northeastern corridor, served as ports of immigration for the people pouring out of Europe. And those peoples brought their particular ethnic worlds with them. And those ethnic worlds have been transplanted here in the United States. And parades or this kind of holiday or that kind of holiday are parts of that transplantation, parts of that ethnicity. But certainly there are parades on Armistice Day, aren't there? And fireworks on... Well, there are in towns in America.
Maybe.
Yeah, I rather suspect that...
Armistice Day is kind of equivocal with Arbor Day now, I guess.
I rather suspect that WASP America expresses itself more in small town parades and in the fire engines making their way through the street as over against things like St. Patrick's Day or the Great Purim Parade, or is it the Hanukkah Parade that takes place here in New York?
That's a very good point that you made. I went to college in Ohio University, in a little tiny town, southeastern Ohio, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm on the National Alumni Board, and so I go there twice a year for alumni board meetings. And the autumn meeting coincides with homecoming, and there's always a homecoming parade. And I was standing on the sidewalk watching the parade last October, and I thought, my God, I mean, I feel like I'm something out of a Norman Rockwell portrait. And there were the fire trucks you mentioned, and there were floats, and all these, and the pretty girls, and the high school marching bands. And I thought, God, I felt like I had been taken back to another century in this country.
Another great WASP parade, I suppose, would be the Rose Bowl. And things along the line of what happens on Thanksgiving. Actually, there are many more WASP parades when you really come to think of what we mean by that than there are these ethnic groupings. There's only one St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, I think we probably lose sight of that here in New York, though.
Yeah, well, you see, what happens also is that the ethnic parades tend, for the most part, to collect just the people who are involved or feeling a loyalty to the particular parade, whereas these general parades attract those people plus the others.
Well, Chaim Potok, I want to go back a little bit and talk a little bit about you, and then work up to Davidas Harp and your writing. I have a feeling that your books are probably autobiographical in many respects. And so I'd like to ask you a little bit about this, your childhood in the Bronx, and what that was like, and how that influenced some of the things that you're writing today.
I grew up in the 30s and 40s in the Bronx, and the 30s were a very bleak time. It was the Depression. That was my first decade, and I remember some pretty sad times in my family and in the families of our relatives and friends.
What did your father do?
My father, when he came here from Poland in the early 20s, ended up in the real estate business, and he did rather well until the Depression quite literally wiped him out. And then he had a long period of time where he rolled from one job to another, and those were very difficult periods of time in the family. Actually, periods of time when there was pretty much nothing to eat in the house. And the kids subsisted on the school lunches and black bread and what have you for suppers at night. Then he went into the jewelry business, and he did rather well, and toward the end of his life didn't do well at all. So his was a life of ups and downs, and in the final stages of his life, I suppose, one of a significant failure. It was a very orthodox home. He was a deeply religious man in the sense of observance. I don't know how religious he was in terms of spiritual piety, but he was meticulous insofar as observing the laws were concerned, ritual laws. To that extent, it was somewhat stifling. I found a measure of refuge from this, first in art, and then when that got to be a little sticky in the family, because art isn't exactly a Jewish thing, especially for a religious Jewish boy, I moved into the area of writing. At the age of about 15, I read A Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh, and that absolutely staggered me, that novel. And the hunger to write was born out of the encounter with that novel, and I've pretty much been writing ever since. And everything that I've done with my education has been to teach me how to write. I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary in order to know my Jewish subject as well as I possibly could. And I went to the University of Pennsylvania for a doctorate in philosophy in order to know the general civilization in which we live. Know both of those civilizations from their cores, because essentially what I'm writing about is what happens to individuals when they're caught in confrontations of ideas that emanate from the hearts of divergent civilizations, divergent ways of looking at the world.
You did become a rabbi.
Well, when you went to the Jewish Theological Seminary in those days and finished, the degree that you got was ordination.
Uh-huh.
But I never wanted to be a rabbi. I wanted the education.
Did you find yourself in the same position as the hero of the Book of Lights, in which you were compelled to become a chaplain?
Oh, yes, very much so. I was in Korea for 15 and a half months.
So that was that is a parallel
very
to your own
so.
Experience.
Very much so, yes.
What was that like?
I came to the Far East with a fairly neat and coherent culture package. It all disintegrated when I was there, and nothing has been the same for me since. I don't think a person with any measure of sensitivity can have an experience like that and come back the same sort of person he or she was, as he might have been when he or she, you know, started that adventure.
You were an active rabbi, though.
I was a chaplain.
A chaplain.
And I was a chaplain with a medical battalion of the 7th Infantry Division Medical Battalion, which was a frontline medical battalion. And then I was with them for about 5 months. And then for the remainder of the time that I was there, and I was there 15 and a half months, I served with an engineer combat battalion, also a frontline battalion. And this was from 56 to 57, the beginning of 56 to the middle of 57. It was just a bit after the shooting had stopped, but there was still strange sort of shooting going on from time to time, and you never knew what you were going to step on that might blow you to pieces, because it was a sort of quasi-combat situation. We were all still in the field. The war was ostensibly over, and yet from time to time the most bizarre sorts of things would happen.
You said you lived in the Far East. Was this a period immediately after Korea?
No, this was the period.
That was. How long were you there?
15 and a half months.
But you never lived in the Far East as outside of that period.
No, I call that living in the Far East. I had a great deal of contact with both Koreans and with Japanese. That sort of goes with a chaplaincy territory where you have considerably more maneuverability than you would normally expect for an army person. I traveled a great deal, got to know Japan very well, got as far as Hong Kong, got over to Japan I think about half a dozen times while I was there. And it was an extraordinary experience for me, the contact with that culture, with that world, with the way it thinks, the human experience, with that religion. My first contact with an idolatrous religion, a pagan world, which anyone growing up in a Western religion, I suppose, is taught to regard as an abomination, and I came to regard it with a great deal of affection. Or all sorts of...
Are you talking about Buddhism?
Well, Buddhism isn't so much a pagan religion as Shintoism is. And certainly elements of Korean religions or nature-bound religions. And it's remarkable to me that I found a great deal of loveliness in those religions. As a matter of fact, I came to love God's world through the beauty that I found in an essentially a pagan civilization, that is to say, the civilization of Japan, with its Shinto gods.
You left Korea. Did you come back to the U.S. to study at the University of Pennsylvania?
I came back to the United States, spent a couple of years in Los Angeles. I think I was recuperating from the Korean experience, and I needed the sunshine. And
what
the
were you
warmth.
Doing out there?
I was teaching in a university out there. Then came east to finish my to do my doctorate in philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Got that. And then took a job as an editor in a publishing house. And then The Chosen was published.
What editing house? What publishing house?
The Jewish Publication Society in Philadelphia, which is soon to celebrate its 100th anniversary. It's the oldest Jewish publishing house in the United States.
Tell me about The Chosen and how that novel developed.
I knew that something had happened to me in Korea wasn't altogether certain what it was, and I knew that sooner or later I'd have to write that experience. The first novel that I wrote really was about Koreans and Americans. It wasn't about Jews at all. It was accepted by the editor of a New York publishing house, but the publisher didn't want to publish it because he felt it wouldn't make any money. So there was a fight between the editor-in-chief and the publisher, and finally I withdrew the novel and began to write the book that ultimately became The Chosen. And what happened was that I backtracked and asked myself, who went to Korea? What culture package did that individual carry with him? And indeed, each of the novels is a different aspect of that culture package. With two of the novels, I actually began with the individual in Seattle waiting for a plane to take him to Korea. And then the novel was a flashback. And then in the later draft, I just eliminated the first section where the individual was in Korea. So what you really have is the flashback without knowing it's a flashback. And this kept happening with novel after novel. So what you have are different aspects of a culture package that an individual carries with him. And then in the Book of Lights, you have the actual confrontation with the Far East.
It's almost as though you could put the Book of Lights and surround it, and surround The Chosen with it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Explain that a little more. You had written a draft of The Chosen that you withdrew and then rewrote. Is that
actually the first book that I wrote ended up being about a half a page incident in the Book of Lights. It was an incident that had to do with the moving of the medical battalion from the valley to the hill and how it affected the Koreans in a small town near the hill, where with the coming of the Americans, that small town was inundated with merchants, with prostitutes, and so on, and the character of the small town was transformed. In addition to that, the place where the Americans were moving had on it a grave of the mother of one of the Korean boys who was working for the medical battalion, and that grave had to be moved. And the Koreans don't at all like moving graves, so there was a problem with that. That incident becomes, in the Book of Lights, just a very brief half-page section. That was the first novel. The second novel became The Chosen. But the first novel was never published.
But you'd certainly made good use of it.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I also made use of it in the sense that it really was my apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Davita's Harp is your new book, and the young girl certainly has questions for everybody. What an inquiring mind that this young person had. Did you know someone like her?
I know someone who's a lot like her, and the rest of it is my imagination. The incident in Bevitasov that triggered the novel, just as the incident with the grave triggered all the other novels that I've written until now, the incident that triggered Davita's harp occurs in the book, toward the end of the book, where Davita is denied the prize that she richly deserves and is denied it because she's a girl. The school giving her that prize will shame the boys in that school. That actually happened. Happened to my wife. And, of course, I've known about this for years. And the incident sort of sat inside me gestating all these years. And I felt that one day I would want to write that story. And having finished that other cycle of novels, I felt myself ready to begin tackling the world through, from the vantage point of a girl.
Well, it's very clear that there is or was discrimination against women within Jewish ranks. It's very clear in Davita's harp, women are not allowed to say Kaddish. Davita would go to shul and find herself separated by a drape or curtain or screen from the others. I don't know, I didn't get a feeling that you were overly critical. It seemed to be more of an observation about what happened, not necessarily a criticism of it. Is that incorrect?
No, I think it's very correct. I don't think it's the job of a novelist to editorialize in his novels. Not unless you want to write a piece of propaganda or a piece of overtly didactic description or a teaching account, a sermonic use of language, something that I prefer very definitely not to do with my books. Now, I would prefer that if there is any negative feeling on the part of the reader toward this particular experience that Davita is having, that it come out of Davita's experience rather than out of my own attempt to verbalize that negative feeling. There are synagogues in which this particular curtain can still be seen today. Most Orthodox synagogues have done away with that curtain. You either have a balcony where the women can look down upon the congregation, or an area that's separated that doesn't necessarily have this huge curtain that you can't look through. But clearly this situation that Davita experiences has been experienced and is still being experienced by many. I don't particularly like it, but my feeling is that it's not for me to say. It's for the women who experience it to say, and I was just trying to see that experience through the eyes of a woman.
Well, you're taking a different view from the writer James Carroll, who is like you in many respects, in that he does write, well, he writes about the experience of Irish American Catholics. But, and he is a former priest. Have you read any of his stuff?
No.
Well, his new book is called Prince of Peace, and it is about a priest who goes to Vietnam and becomes vehemently anti-war. And the book is scathing in its criticism of the Catholic Church, as is Carroll himself. He's almost a spokesman. He's still he claims to be a loyal Catholic, no longer a priest. He's married, he has children. But your approach is certainly more subtle than his. I mean, Carroll just slaps you.
my feeling in this is, personally, I am very against this way of treating half the species. I think it's an idea whose time has come for disappearance. But that's neither here nor there in terms of creating a novel. My feeling is that in the creation of a novel, certain aesthetic demands come into play, and that if you're too obvious, too didactic, that what you end up doing is defeating your own purposes. It ought to be the sort of reading experience where you can get the feeling tone of the author through the individual that you're reading about without the author hitting you over the head. Indeed, it ought to be the sort of experience whereby each time you reread it, you ought to see something that you haven't seen before. And if the whole game is given away the first time around, nobody's really going to be interested in rereading what you've said or what you've done.
You use an interesting device in Davidus harp, and that indeed is this very unusual harp that attaches to the door. I've never heard of a harp like that before. Tell me a little bit about that.
My wife and I, every summer for the longest time, have been traveling through New England. I love that part of the country. And one summer on the way through Vermont, my wife spotted this there, and it's up there it's called a Vermont door harp, or a New England door harp. And they're not too sure themselves how it got into the country. They think it was brought over by some of our soldiers who came back from the First World War. And we bought two of them. One of them is hanging on the door of our home in Pennsylvania. And it's precisely as it's pictured on the dust jacket. And the dimensions of the door harp that we have are given right at the beginning of the novel. It's a beautiful thing to come into a house and have that music strike you in the ear. So that's a real door harp. And so what happened was that I began to utilize that as a metaphor for the book.
Explain the metaphor.
The metaphor, Davita herself explains, it has to do with the kinds of music that the bird in the book is searching for, and the kind of music that Davita senses in the door harp every time that door opens and closes on the sounds of joy and anguish inside her family. As the family spins out its life against the background of the Spanish Civil War, the growth of fascism in the 30s, the oncoming Second World War, what it is that happens to her father and her mother, who are very much involved in Marxist causes, what it is that happens to her as she becomes slowly involved in matters having to do with religion and so on. This harp is constantly pinging and tinging.
Well, you certainly do your research as you set your novels in these periods of the 30s and 40s. What do? You go to the library, newspaper, old newspapers, or how do you do it?
Oh, yes, to all of the above. Newspapers, magazines, libraries, newsreels of that period, tapes, my own memory. I grew up in that time. An awful lot of reading.
Your own memory. I can't remember what I did last year. Who played for the Yankees. So.
But there is a memory of feelings that one has. I don't trust my memory of details. I would always double-check details, but I trust very profoundly my intuitions regarding the feeling tones of the periods of time that I've lived through. That's what I pretty much fly by. That's really what I write about. I write about the feelings of people involved in those times.
Where in Pennsylvania do you live?
Right outside of Philadelphia in the township of Marion.
Do you work out of your home?
Yes.
But you're writing full time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Tell me about how you approach your writing schedule. How do you do it?
Well, I write every day. Usually I start about 9 or so in the morning and go until 12:30 or 1, break for an hour. Then I'll write until about 6, have dinner, and then it depends. If I'm on a roll, then I'll continue. Very often I'll just do research at night for the next day's work. And sometimes we'll go out to a movie or to dinner with some friends, or we'll go to the Academy of Music for a concert, my wife and I. We'll just relax at home. And then just pick it up again the next day.
Do you always have a project going, or do you find yourself in kind of a restful state now that...
No, I'm finishing up another major project for the Villard Division of Random House, which is putting out a museum book. And I'm... I've just about finished the text for that book. I've just another 5 pages or so to go. Interestingly enough, usually after the previous novels, I took a respite of a few months and would spend the time painting and drawing, which I love to do.
No, I've gone back to art.
Yes. But this time around, after Davita's harp, there was no rest. I did a screenplay for Fred Zinnemann, and then took on this museum book, and now there's another novel that's beginning to bother me, and I suppose I'll be getting to that very quickly.
Let me guess, you have the hero waiting at the airport in Seattle.
No, that's finished. That's interesting. I really think that with the Book of Lights, that cycle has been, if you'll pardon the mixed metaphor, mined. And unless something surprising occurs, I don't think I'll go back to that. Some of the characters in that cycle may appear again, as one of them does suddenly in Davita's harp at near the end of the book. One of the characters from The Chosen and The Promise suddenly pops up in Davita's harp. But I don't think the subject matter or that particular world or that point of view will be written about again unless, as I say, there are levels in it that I don't see at this point and that will become apparent later on.
What? Tell me a little bit about the art work that you do.
Well, when I was about nine, I began to draw and paint, and it turned out that I was not too bad at it. And by the time I was 13, it became a significant problem in the family. I thought I really wanted to be an artist, and my father would have nothing to do with that. I mean, that was really stuff that Gentiles did, not Jews. Judaism has had no adventure in depth with Western art. And there were rather uncomfortable times in the family, and I suspect he was very grateful when I finally gave it up after reading Brideshead Revisited and began to write. Writing, you sit off in a corner somewhere and you're very quiet. Painting, you have a tendency to be very obtrusive, and also the turpentine quite often changes the atmospherics of the apartment. So I began to write, but the painting has always stayed, and after The Chosen was published, my wife bought me a beautiful easel, and I found myself right back at it.
What do you paint?
Oils and gouaches. And
landscapes, people, portraits?
Yes, all of that. Yes.
Everything.
Yes. Not the sort of expressionist style, if you want to pigeonhole a style. Yeah.
Are you painting for pleasure, or do you ultimately hope to display them in a gallery?
No, I have shown.
Yeah,
I've shown, and I've sold, and I sell. And
oh.
Yes.
Oh. Have you? Have they been on display here in New York?
I don't think so. I'm trying to remember, but I don't really think so. They have been in Los Angeles, in Philadelphia, in Washington, in other places.
Yeah. How do you like living in Pennsylvania?
I like it very much. It's close enough to New York so that when I need New York, I can hop into it. It's far enough away to be very quiet, and I need the quiet.
You're in a township near New Hope?
Yes, not far away.
Yeah, that's
about 30, 40, 45 minutes away. That's lovely.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Right? Yeah.
Well, Chaim Potok, thank you very much for spending the last half hour with me and giving me a synopsis of your life and how you work, and I like your stuff, and I wish you the best with it, and I hope that we'll be able to get together at another point and we'll talk some more.
Thank you. It was good to be here.
Preferably when your new book comes out, give us a catalyst.
Thank you.
Bye.